caution is advised.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. It's 11 o'clock Eastern Time, Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. And thank you for joining us for the 103rd episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Right. As always, thank you for that, and if you don't mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Okay, so when I was picking a song for tonight, I thought I'd pick something that was kind of somewhat deep cutty but still reflective of the theme. So that was a song originally written by a Nashville songwriter called Mark James, who wrote the song and recorded it initially, but it wasn't that popular until Elvis got his hands on it the following year. So that was Suspicious Minds, and what's interesting is it's going to be also related to our my trivia topic tonight. So I thought that was, I'm kind of getting a two-for-oneer. And what was interesting, and I'll throw this in because it is sort of related, during the recording of the Elvis version of Suspicious Minds, the piano player and the background, one of the piano players, the background vocalist was Ronnie Milsap, who, as most of you know, went on to record a bunch of songs, both for himself and write a bunch of tunes for other folks. And also in the background vocalist on the track, one of them was Donna Jean Godichaud, who was a soon-to-be a future Grateful Dead member. So I just thought this was kind of a cool, I just thought this would be kind of a cool song to use on the session, since we're going to be talking about people who have suspicious minds.
Fair enough. Okay. So as Dr. Mathis is alluding to, tonight's episode is entitled Paranoid Personality Disorder versus Delusional Disorder, which we will discuss in detail in a moment. And before we begin, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so continuing in the Nashville genre, having just recently received some new babies for the nursery, I know that comes as a shock to all my listeners and to yourself who know what a how many few guitars I actually own.
like half your downstairs, I believe.
Well, actually, they're upstairs now because they just floored the basement. So I had to move all the guitars. And, oh, my God. Let me tell you. Let me tell you what a pain in the patootie that was, moving like 200 and something guitars. Oh, my Lord. Anyway, I recently got my hands. Yeah, I recently got my hands on a couple of Master Bills from Stephen Stern, who is probably the longest running Master Biller for Gretsch guitars. And they're really awesome. They're Penguins. I love them. But I also recently got a custom shop Falcon with Ray Butts pickups in it, Filtertrons in it. And the reason that that's important is because Ray Butts, technical name Joseph Raymond Butts, but nicknamed Ray, was an inventor and engineer who actually did the Filtertron pickups for Gretsch guitars originally. He's the guy who developed them. Prior to him making the Filtertron pickups, what they were using was like D'Armond style pickups, which are single coils, and the Filtertrons are all humbuckers. Now, they don't sound like a Gibson humbucker or other humbuckers. They have kind of an interesting character to them. And they can be kind of crunchy. They can be kind of rockabilly-y. I know that's not a word. But you've heard them on numerous Gretsch's guitars because they're kind of the stand. They became the standard after he really got them going and developed them. They sort of became the standard for the Gretsch guitars, and they replaced the original D'Armond pickups that were in the first Gretsches from like late 50s to early to mid 60s. And actually that was kind of the allure to the two Master Bills that I got, because they're both Stephen Stern Master Bills. One's a 57 and one's a 62. And so both of those have the original D'Armond type pickups in them. So they have a totally different vibe than my other Gretsches, all of which have various types of Filtertrons, because now the days they make, you know, Powertrons and Filtertron pluses and, you know, a shoot ton of different, you know, iterations of the Filtertron. But the guy who originally did it was Ray Butts. And this custom shop Falcon, Blue Falcon, has Ray Butts designed pickups in it. So it's got a different vibe from the other Filtertrons. At any rate, originally born in, I think, 1919 or 1920, I can't remember which. I think it's 1919. He originally got interested in building amplifiers with a built-in tape echo, and moved from that to making the humbucker Filtertron pickups for Gretsch guitars. So started out as a builder, kind of very much like Fender did. Most people don't know Leo Fender never played guitar. He was strictly an engineer and an inventor. He did not play guitar at all, which just kind of blows my mind. But anyway, so he started getting friendly with people like Sam Phillips at Sun Records and Chet Atkins. So he moved to Cairo, Illinois, and then eventually moved to Calumet City, where he started playing in various clubs. He was an accordion player. He wasn't a guitarist. And so he started playing accordion, and, you know, he was kind of doing inventive stuff on the side because he was working for an appliance store as a repairman for GE products, I believe. So he started thinking, well, shoot, if I can do this, I can build amplifiers. And so he started doing side work, building amps, and eventually built his own amplification and under the logo of Ray Butts Music. And it was a little small music store. And he and his wife, I think his wife's name was Ann, did the storefront and kept the books and kept tinkering and stuff, and eventually built this amp he called the Echo Sonic. And he attracted the attention of a local guitar player in the early 50s. I think his name was Bill Gwatney, who was a buddy and an admirer of Les Paul, who was known for his experiments with echo and taping and that kind of stuff. So eventually, Butts built him a 15-watt or early amplifier. He modified a 15-watt Gibson for him. And eventually, in, I think, 54, Butts went to Nashville, and that's where he hooked up with Chet Atkins and sort of got talking with him and sort of modded Chet's stuff. And, you know, in fact, the amp that he modded, it was a Fender Twin, that he modded and also sold him, I think, an Echosonic amp, which actually was on one of Chet's recordings, I think, of Mr. Sandman. And he also came to the attention of a guitarist in Nashville called Scotty Moore. So there's the connection to the song that I played tonight, because Scotty Moore was Elvis's guitar player for a long time, until Elvis went off and joined military. And then when Elvis came back, James Burton took over guitar duties, but Scotty Moore played all the early rockabilly stuff. And so that's kind of the connection that, one of the reasons I picked the song I did. So he produced, So in 54, Gretsch started producing the first Chet Atkins, because Chet Atkins played Gretsch's almost exclusively. There was only like 1 or 2 years that he actually played Gibson's, and he got Gibson, he commissioned Gibson to make him a special guitar. And I don't know what happened, but he only made it like 1 or 2 years, and he went back to Gretsch. And actually, I have one of those guitars. It's really cool. It's all solid. It's all walnut. It's a hollow body, but it's all walnut everywhere, back, sides, neck. It's really cool. And it's got the old school pickups in it, so it's really neat. At any rate, it looks more like a Gretsch than it does a Gibson, which, gee, what a shock that is, right? So eventually, Gretsch made the 60, what they call the 6120, which is the early Chet Atkins model. And all of those had the Filtertrons, because the hums, they started out with the old single coils, and Chet and all the other guitar players were complaining about it, because all the single coil pickups had this hum on them, because they have an unshielded transformer in most of the amps back in the day. And even today, a lot of the single coils will still produce this, you know, single cycle hum. And so the humbuckers, to buck the hum, gee, I wonder where they came up with that name. Yeah, that's why they came up. I mean, seriously, that's how they came up with it. It's a humbucker, because it's basically two single coil pickups that are wired serially but out of phase. So when you wire them out of phase, you get rid of the hum. And so Butz was the first guy to do that and develop this pickup he called the Filtertron. And even though Gibson actually is on record as being the first person to develop a humbucker pickup, that's really not true. Butz developed the pickup first, but Gibson got to the patent office first. So if you look at the data on the patent, Gibson Corporation had the first humbucker copywritten or patented, if you will. But the Filtertron was the second, but actually Butz did the Filtertron prior to Gibson. They just got to the patent office center. So all the pickups, especially in the first couple of years of making it, Butz hand-wired all the Filtertron pickups himself. And then eventually, the Filtertrons were produced en masse, and Gretsch, of course, went to more, you know, production, team building, and then, you know, machine production, machine wiring. Because if you've ever tried to wire a pickup by hand, it is painful. I mean, it literally, as you see there, wrapping a magnet wire around a piece of metal, trying to make it into a magnet, like thousands of times. So it's pretty excruciating. But anyway, Ray Butz is the guy that invented the Filtertron, and actually the very first humbucker pickup that is still used standard in 99% of the Gretsches to this day. Except on very rare instances where they'll happen to do a reissue of a late 50s or an early 60s, or if Steven Stern, the Master Bug Guy, does a one-off. He loves those old D'Armond pickups, and so he'll often do the D'Armonds in there, or he'll mix the D'Armonds with the Filtertron, so it's kind of cool. But the Blue Falcon that I have has the Ray Butz in them, so it's really cool. It's just a piece of history, and I just love it. So there you go. Mr. Butson died in 2003, I think. Ann passed, I think, in 2008. So the Ray Butz pickups are done to his original spec. He obviously didn't mind it, because he's not able to do that right now. I don't mean to be rude or catty. So I wanted just to do a shout out to him, because he's kind of a pioneer in the electronic field, very much, you know, like a lot of the folks of his genre, you know, Fender and Orville Gibson and a lot of those folks. But a lot of people don't know who it is. So, it's, again, it's one of those things. Thought I'd want to throw my 2 cents in and give credit where credit is due to the guy that developed the first humbucker pickup, but the second copywritten, or trademarked, patented, I'll get it right in a minute, pickup.
Fun. Okay. Cool. Well, thank you very much for that. Always appreciated a fun little story. It's always nice to kind of get a glimpse of something that people didn't realize. So let's give some applause for that. All righty. So thanks again. And we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening up until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All righty. So, paranoid personality disorder versus delusional disorder. So, this show has done several episodes on various pathologies that are darlings of pop culture and media. The conditions that most of us have heard of, most likely first from a book, a song, a TV show, or a movie. For various reasons, certain pathologies seem to craft an enticing story in our eyes or command more interest than others. But it also seems, very noisy. It also seems that some of the allure may be the fictionalized, often inaccurate portrayals of what we imagine or fantasize a specific condition to be like. Interesting or compelling characters can often generate an inaccurate, fond nostalgia for certain diagnoses. Paranoia is one such pathology, and like many similar conditions, similar in that it's popular because of pop culture, the terminology and understanding of it by many laypersons are significantly inaccurate compared to the medical reality. So we've talked about romanticizing certain conditions back in our two-part series from 2017, which was episodes 24 and 25, Pathology Chic and Misconceptions. And then also we warned about layperson self-diagnosis back in episode 7, which was Armchair Psychology in October 2016. So those enter into what we're going to talk about tonight. We are going to discuss the history of paranoid personality disorder and delusional disorder. Paranoid personality disorder versus delusional disorder today. Differences and misconceptions about them and resources and coping with either one. We will start off the evening with classic trivia, which we just finished, and our topic discussion will follow in a second. Dr. Mathis, is there anything that you want to add before we get started?
No, let's get to it.
All right, let's get to it then. So, the history of paranoid personality disorder and delusional disorder, and just to let you guys know, as we have done in a couple of episodes recently, I've had a little bit over full plate. And I have cut back on the detail. So I've still got some data for you guys, but some of this will be me putting Dr. Mathis on the spot a little more often, which is fine. And he can flesh out the topic for us since he picked it. All right, so paranoid personality disorder, first, is listed in the DSM-5 and was included in all previous versions of the DSM ever. One of the earliest descriptions of the paranoid personality comes from the French psychiatrist Valentin Magnan, who described a fragile personality, quote, that showed idiosyncratic thinking, hypochondriasis, undue sensitivity, referential thinking, and suspiciousness. In the 1980s, paranoid personality disorder received little attention. And when it did receive it, the focus was on its potential relationship to paranoid schizophrenia. And that's a theory we'll talk about in a bit. The most significant contribution of this decade, the 80s, comes from Theodore Milon, M-I-L-O-N, who divided the features of paranoid personality disorder into four categories, which were behavioral characteristics of vigilance, abrasive irritability, and counterattack. 2, complaints indicating oversensitivity, social isolation, and mistrust. 3, the dynamics of denying personal insecurities, attributing these to others, and self-inflation through grandiose fantasies. And 4, coping style of detesting dependence and hostile distancing of oneself from others. And I actually have a question that I did not write down on my notes, but after looking at this and saying it out loud, I'm curious, Dr. Mathis, if you can kind of real quick extemporaneously speak to how this sort of stuff differs from things like what used to be BPD, and especially narcissism, and certain famous entities who have a lot of these behaviors but don't apparently have this pathology. How do we differentiate this list from, because these are symptoms, they're not necessarily unique.
Right.
So how do we
right.
draw the line here between these?
Okay, so when Milan came up with this stuff, and Theodore Milan's work is still used, there's a personality test that came out from a lot of his work that's still in use today. So basically, paranoid personality disorder belongs to a group of personality disorders. And I think I probably mentioned on a previous show, but I'm going to go ahead and kind of do a brief recapping here. Personality disorders under the DSM, and this has been true since day one, are grouped into 3 groups, categories, or clusters, cluster A, cluster B, cluster C. So cluster C are the folks who have fear-based, their dynamics revolve around fear-based stuff. Cluster B, their dynamics revolve around drama. And cluster A, their dynamics revolve around odd or eccentric behavior. And paranoid personality disorder, right. And so paranoid personality disorder is a cluster A disorder, which also includes things like schizotypal personality disorder, right?
Okay.
And schizoidal personality disorder. So it's mm-hmm. it's people who are, they're funky, you know. They're not all there in reality. They're not what most people would call crazy, you know. But they're in the vernacular of the South, them boys and girls ain't right. And I'm from the South, so I can make fun of it. So, you know, all you Southerners, chill out, y'all. Anyway, I have too much fun of this. So what happens is you'll see very similar kinds of things to differing degrees under the folks that are classified as cluster A. You will also see occasionally some similar dynamics in the other 2 personality groups or clusters. So, for example, you'll see folks who are borderline personality disorder, which is a cluster B, right, tend to be uberly interpersonally sensitive and sort of paranoid-esque and overly sensitive in critiques of their stuff. They take stuff over personally, you know, kind of like the paranoid personality disorder folks do. So you'll see some crossovers in their symptomatology, and the same thing with some of the cluster C people. So that's why, you know, I joke about it, but that's why I say, you know, these are professionals. Don't try this stuff at home, because it's so easy to confuse this stuff just because some of these things have very similar traits, but to differing degrees, and then they have other traits that the other disorders don't have. And so you really have to know your cookies to do this stuff. That's part of the reason, you know, why I do testing. Because when I do something, you know, when I do an elongated interview, which, I typically do a 2-hour intake interview, and I get a family history and a presenting issues and kind of get a sense of what the person's like in it personally, and then I do, you know, the MMPI, for example, that really, really nails what are we dealing with here. I recently got a referral for a case where someone was misdiagnosed bipolar, psychotic, and what was the other one? How quickly he forgets. Antisocial. And they didn't officially diagnose this person antisocial because this person's not quite 18 yet. But they said, hey, this person's going to become an antisocial because they have conduct disorder, which is true. This person does have conduct disorder. But this person's going to become an antisocial, and you really need to, you know, gear yourself up for having a kid who's a sociopath. Okay, well, if you do the testing on this kid, you'll see clearly that this kid does not meet any of the criteria for any of those three aforementioned disorders, but has other symptomatology of disorders that have some similar traits to bipolar, for example, and schizophrenia, for example, because this person has a dopamine-related disorder. And when this person gets agitated and the dopamine gets jiggled, this person overreacts like most people with this person's diagnosis. And if you see this person in a stress-related situation, it might be easy to see why this person might get diagnosed as one of those things. But if you're a mental health professional and you do your J-O-B and, you know, sit back and go, okay, well, wait a minute, what's the evidence here? We see this outburst, but what's the story with this? What's the story with this? And you do your due diligence, you see this person doesn't suffer from any of these disorders other than conduct disorder, which is accurate. And unfortunately, with the medication that goes with the other disorders that this person's been misdiagnosed as, suppressed dopamine, which is the last thing this person needs because their primary disorder is a deficiency of dopamine. Oops. Don't even get me started. So this is why you should do full battery evals on everybody that you have a convoluted case upon. And even though this person has had a couple of pretty decent evals, I have to say, the most recent person didn't seem to, the professional, and I use the term in quotes, didn't seem to look at those things and go, well, wait a minute. So here we are, and the good news is they found me, and I can undo the crap. Now, of course, I can't undo the damage that's been done with the inappropriate medication, but I can certainly suggest that the parents go back to the physician and go, hey, can we, like, dial this shit down? You know?
Yeah.
Which I have done. So, you know, that's why sometimes when people look at this stuff, they're confused because they're like, well, wait a minute. You know, or you read the DSM, you're like, oh, my God, I have that. No.
Oh, that's why we did a whole episode about not doing that.
Uh-huh. And I have to tell you that the two of the worst people that do that are medical students and psychology students. They're the worst.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. It's so funny.
That's a pretty expensive for them to go get a degree just so they can misdiagnose themselves.
Yeah. Well, they do it usually in the process. By the time they're at the end, they're like, okay, wait a minute. Maybe I overreacted. But yeah. Early on, you know, they're flipping through the DSM going, oh, my God, I've got that. Oh, my God, oh, my God. You know?
Yeah.
You're like, settle down, Beavis.
Yeah. Yeah, I am glad you brought that up, though, because I've mentioned to many people in conversations about this stuff, about how your testing is more rigorous than many of your peers, and people who don't know you very well or of your work kind of raise an eyebrow, you know, like, why does it need so much drama? But then there are so many of these stories of people you've run into who were misdiagnosed, and the stuff that they were doing based on the bad diagnosis was doing so much damage.
Yep.
And people don't realize this until later on, you know, when you've had a chance to clean it up. It's like you don't know what you don't know until all of a sudden the light goes on and it's like angels coming out of your butt and the whole thing.
Yeah, I really, you know, and honest to God, I see, and I'm not joking, I see hundreds of these every year. And then I vacillate between being ready to go out and, you know, kill about half the people who do what I do versus crying over the loss that these people have experienced due to other people's negligence and or to their the patient themselves or their, parents or, you know, whatever, taking the easy way out and going, well, I don't want to pay all that testing. Let's just, you know. And you see the damage, and it both angers me and saddens the heck out of me when I see it. It's just, I kind of shake my head and just go, come on, people, really? It's so sad. I mean, honest to God, it is so doggone sad. And, you know, the best I can do is do what I can do that people will allow me to do and clean up what I can clean up and support the folks and try to give them some hope that they can get their brains back. And if they do what I, you know, ask them to do and follow the treatment regimen that the data clearly indicates, they will get better and their brains will, you know, rehab. I can't promise how much their brains will rehab, but I've seen some pretty amazing rehabilitation cases that I've worked on where people have really towed the line and done their job and claimed their power. And boy, have they done a good job of that stuff. And I'm just like, woohoo for you.
Excellent.
Yeah, all right, I just love that happens.
Let's go ahead and get to the other question that I had in this section. We're talking about the history.
Sure.
Real quick, do you know when did they change the naming of the disorder and why? And when did it become not paranoia, quote unquote?
Okay, because it will destroy you.
Yeah,
I had to. Thank you, Ray Davis. And his name in England is pronounced Davis. For you Americans, that's Ray Davies of the Kinks.
Oh,
so
I'm glad you pointed that out. I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, you Americans out there, what the hell?
Yeah,
I'm always talk funny. So when I'm in my funny southern mood today, what can I tell you? I may end up losing my southern card because of this. Anyway, that and the fact that I've never grilled, but I digress. So, oh no, who's going to be beeping on, Mr. Bill? So, when DSM-4 came out, they changed the term from paranoia to delusional disorder in order to keep people from being confused between paranoia or paranoid and paranoid personality disorder. And that was strictly a name change to, you know, keep people from being confused about it, which is, you know, it's the same principle why they changed multiple personality disorder to dissociative identity disorder, because it's not, you know, it's not really a personality disorder. You're not taking it anywhere, you know, to channel my inner, you know, Andy Rooney.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they changed it to keep people from being confused, really, because delusional disorder, as you probably know, belongs to the category of psychotic disorders. So the two big psychotic disorders are delusional disorder and schizophrenia and its many forms. So they changed it from paranoid disorder to delusional disorder strictly to keep confusion apart from being officially delusional and just being paranoid personality disorder, which are two very different disorders, which we'll talk about tonight.
Yes, we will. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for explaining that. And is there anything else that you want to mention about the history of this before we get into the next section?
No, let's kick it. Let's get going.
Okay. So let's talk about this stuff today as we know it, paranoid personality disorder versus delusional disorder. So I'm going to talk just about how they're understood now, and I will probably pause in between so Dr. Mathis can jump in. So first, let's talk about paranoid personality disorder. So what is it? Paranoid personality disorder, or PPD, is one of a group of conditions called Cluster A, as Dr. Mathis already broke down for you earlier, or eccentric personality disorders. People with these disorders often appear odd or peculiar. And more so than me, I mean. The essential characteristic of people with PPD is paranoia, a relentless mistrust and suspicion of others without adequate reason to be suspicious. That's really key.
Uh-huh.
This disorder, yeah, as somebody who has PTSD, and I am very mistrustful of a lot of things because I've had bad experiences, I have a reason for mine, so that is part of how you know that's not what I have, because mine actually has a source. So this disorder often begins in childhood or early adolescence and appears to be more common in men than in women. All right, what causes paranoid personality disorder? So the exact cause of PPD is not known, but it likely involves a combination of biological and psychological factors. The fact that PPD is more common in people who have close relatives with schizophrenia and delusional disorder suggests a genetic link between the two disorders, like it may run in the family somehow. It's also believed that early childhood experiences, including physical or emotional trauma, can play a role in the development of PPD. What are the symptoms of paranoid personality disorder? People with PPD are always on guard, believing that others are constantly trying to demean, harm, or threaten them. These generally unfounded beliefs, as well as their habits of blame and distrust, interfere with their ability to form close or even workable relationships. People with this disorder are generally cold and distant in their relationships with others and might become controlling and jealous to avoid being betrayed. They are hostile, stubborn, and argumentative. They are hypersensitive and take criticism poorly, and not in the way of ADHD with their rejection dysphoria and all that kind of bit. They are reluctant to confide in others or reveal personal information because they are afraid the information will be used against them. They are unforgiving and hold grudges big time. They cannot see their role in problems or conflicts. Like you say, you know, it takes two to tango. They don't understand how they're part of the tango. They believe they're always right. They doubt the commitment, loyalty, or trustworthiness of others, believing others are exploiting or deceiving them. They have difficulty relaxing, you know, because if you're constantly on edge and hypervigilant like that, you know, it's very hard. They have persistent suspicions without reason, key point, that their spouses or lovers are being unfaithful. They perceive attacks on their character that are not apparent to others. They generally react with anger and are quick to retaliate. They read hidden meaning to the innocent remarks or casual looks of others.
Definitely.
And they tend to develop negative stereotypes of others, especially those from different cultural groups. And before we get to the next part, I'm going to pause here and see if Dr. Mathis wants to add anything else.
Yeah, I can definitely tell you that the gender differences are definitely true. I've only seen one that I can remember, paranoid personality disorder, female. Every other one I've ever seen was a male.
It's very interesting. Do you know, have they done any studies on why they think this is? Is there some kind of biological component that they've identified?
Not that I know of. I can tell you that all the people I've seen, both the obligatory one woman and however many guys I've seen, have all had some kind of other accompanying disorder which sort of made this really blossom, or most commonly post-traumatic stress disorder or some kind of experience that would be PTSD-like, that they'd become like very, 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 you know, paranoid personality disorder. I had a couple who, excuse me, I didn't have a couple who had other relatives in the family who they thought had paranoia, what used to be called paranoia, now called delusional disorder. But I had no, you know, definite, you know, documentation on that. They said, oh, well, so-and-so used to do so. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that's downright delusional. But Right.
Okay, fair enough. All right. So, speaking of which, the other disorder we're talking about, delusional disorder, is characterized in the DSM-5 as the presence of one or more delusions for a month or longer in a person who, except for the delusions and their behavioral ramifications, does not appear odd and is not functionally impaired. So, delusional disorder involves delusions that aren't bizarre, having to do with situations that could happen in real life, like being followed, poisoned, deceived, conspired against, or loved from a distance. These delusions usually involve mistaken perceptions or experiences. But in reality, the situations are either not true at all or highly exaggerated. A bizarre delusion, by contrast, is something that could never happen in real life, such as being cloned by aliens or having your thoughts broadcast on TV. A person who has such thoughts as this might be considered delusional with bizarre-type delusions. Delusional disorder is a generally rare mental illness in which a person presents delusions but with no accompanying prominent hallucinations, thought disorder, mood disorder, or significant flattening of affect. Delusions are a specific symptom of psychosis. Diagnostic criteria for delusional disorder from the DSM-5. While the essential feature of this disorder is simply the existence of one or more delusions that occur for at least 1 month, the following are all used to make a correct diagnosis of delusional disorder. The individual has one or more delusions that persist for at least a month or more, as we said. Criterion A for schizophrenia is not and has never been met, so that's been ruled out. Aside from the delusion direct effects, functioning is not obviously impaired otherwise, and behavior is not noticeably strange otherwise. Any manic or major depressive episodes, have been brief compared to the length of the delusional period, and the disturbance cannot be attributed to the physiological effects of a substance, another medical condition, or another mental disorder. The severity of the delusions should be noted, and it should also be specified if delusions involve bizarre content or are clearly implausible. Additionally, there are a few subtypes with specific delusional themes that should be specified. Erotomanic type. This is involves delusions about another person being in love with the affected individual. Grandiose type. Individuals with the grandiose type of delusional disorder believe they have a great talent which is unrecognized or made a great important discovery. And, of course, obviously this is in the absence of any empirical data otherwise. Jealous type. This involves delusions about his or her lover being unfaithful. Persecutory type. This subtype pertains to individuals with delusions involving their beliefs that they're being conspired against, spied or cheated on, poisoned or drugged, harassed, followed, or generally obstructed in the pursuit of long-term goals. Somatic type. Individuals with somatic type of delusional disorder have delusions involving bodily functions and or sensations. Mixed type. There's not one delusional theme that persists over others. And unspecified type. The dominant delusional belief cannot be clearly determined or does not fall into the descriptions of any of the specific types. The functional consequences of delusional disorder. The majority of individuals suffering from this often appear normal, quote unquote normal. We should probably say typical, but that was the wording in the book. Especially when they are not acting on or discussing their delusions. However, it is possible, though rare, for affected individuals to experience substantial impairment and poor occupational functioning, as well as social isolation. And at this point, I have a question for Dr. Mathis. How would you describe the main differences between PPD and DD, and how does this differ from schizotypal issues or full-on schizophrenia?
Okay. So the PPD, people are much more easier to spot. They kind of look funky. They look weird. They look uncomfortable in social situations. They look kind of, for lack of a better term, nerdy, and I'm a nerd, so I can say that. and they just, they look almost, in some cases, they look almost autism spectrum-y when they get into crowds of people. The delusional disorder people don't necessarily do that. You can't pick them out in a crowd. They're not like, what's wrong with that person? You know, that like if a paranoid personality disorder person's at a party, if they even go to a party, people might, you know, wonder like, hey, what's wrong with that person? They would not usually say that about a delusional disorder person. You wouldn't know it. Unless the delusional disorder person were in the throes of a delusional episode. Now, if they're doing that and they're starting to freak out and doing crazy crap, then yeah, they're going to come to your attention. But other than that, you can't really spot them out. The big difference between the two is that PDD people, in common layman's terms, aren't crazy. The delusional disorder people are nuts. They're crazy. They are clearly psychotic. They clearly are not grounded in reality. They really believe like the erotomanic types, really believe that certain people are in love with them, or, you know, or infatuated with them, and you can't talk them out of it. You present them with all this data, and they yes but the data away. And the same thing with jealous types of, and the same thing with the persecutory types or the grandiose types or whatever. You can't talk them out of it. You know, it's kind of like the joke.
So there's a full-on break from reality with it.
Oh,
those.
God, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like the Mel Brooks line in History of the World, where he says, you know, let's face it, you can't talk Torquemada of anything when he's introducing Torquemada. That's kind of the... Right, and that's the delusionalist order of people. You can't talk them out of anything. They come back with the yes but game, the same thing as schizophrenics do, because both schizophrenia and delusionalist order are psychotic disorders. They're both people who are not, you know, they're not in this realm of reality, right? And that's the difference between schizotypal or schizotypal, depending on how you want to pronounce it, personality disorder, and schizophrenia. The schizotypals aren't crazy. They're not nuts. They don't have, and I'm not saying that to belittle schizophrenics in any way, so I don't want anybody to get all PO'd about that. The schizotypals don't have systemized delusions or hallucinations. They're odd or eccentric. They might play Dungeons and Dragons and get lost in fantasy for a while and prefer the fantasy world and, you know, Harlequin romance novels and, you know, want to dress up like Harlequin people or whatever, but they know the difference in reality and fantasy. The schizophrenics do not. For those who don't know the difference in delusions and hallucinations, just to clarify, delusions are belief systems that don't hold to the criteria of reality, so you can disprove them very easily. They're ideas that hold zero water, that you cannot prove in any way, shape, or form. They're not just an opinion. They are staunch belief systems that actually defy reality, right? Hallucinations are either visual, tactile, touching, olfactory, smelling, gustatory, tasting, or auditory hearing, actual things that aren't there, that nobody else sees or hears or smells or touches or tastes. So schizophrenics usually have both. Schizotypals have neither.
Okay.
So that's a huge difference in the two.
Okay, fair. All right, thank you for that.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and talk about differences and misconceptions.
Okay.
So I've got another question for you.
Okay.
I did not really find a whole lot of data about misunderstandings about PPD. I did find some about DD, but we'll get to those in a minute. But do you find that there's anything in particular about PPD that tends to be a stereotype that's inaccurate? You know, things that, you know, urban legends about stuff, how it rolls, anything like that?
There's a couple of things I would say. A lot of times people who have suspicious tendencies will often get labeled as either PDD or full-blown delusional disorder when they're just kind of suspicious, distrustful people. And you have to be really, I mean, when you look at the criteria for PPD, you know, you have to do like 5 out of 7, I forget how many it is now, to be honest with you, of the criteria. You can't just be really suspicious and then not have any of the other symptoms. You know, you can't react angrily and you can't do all this, you know. There's a difference in somebody who's just kind of distrusting and somebody who's full-blown PDD. So that's often, they'll often say, oh, you just have this paranoid personality. They'll just say you're just paranoid. And then under the same misconception, they'll think anybody that has PPD or anybody who's just very suspicious is full-blown delusional. And they'll go, oh, you're just crazy. You're just paranoid. And I hear that a lot. And then I have to go out and go, no, there's a difference. This person is dealing in reality. They may or may not have paranoid personality disorder, don't have enough interactions with them, don't have any testing data to substantiate that. I can tell you they're suspicious. That's absolutely true. But, you know, just being suspicious and a little distrusting and kind of standing back until you go, wait a minute, this person's okay. I need to be cool with this person. The paranoid personality disorder people almost never do that. They always have the, okay, well, this person's okay now. Let me see what they do next time. Let me see what they do, you know, in three get-togethers from now. You know, they're waiting. They're always waiting for the other shoe to fall. The suspicious person, particularly if they've had some trauma or had some, you know, betrayals in their life and they have a reason to have some suspiciousness, you know, they get around somebody who is genuine four or five or six times and they vetted themselves, are like, okay, got it. This person's different. I can trust this person. The PPD people never do that. And the delusional people definitely don't do it. But the delusional people just don't have any, they don't have any basis in reality. So a lot of people will misperceive suspicious behaviors as either being delusional or PPD. And that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
Right. And I'll give you a really great example. I met on my travels to Idaho. I met some folks there, and most of the folks there, you know, didn't quite know what to do with me, as you can imagine. But there was a couple of people who met me that they were just kind of looking at me like, I don't know about this guy, you know. But as they met me three or four times, they went, okay, wait a minute, he's just weird. You know, he's okay. He's just a little, you know, left of center. He's, you know, and they've warmed up to me and become very friendly and all. So those people might be suspicious. They may be cautious. They may have had trauma in their life. I don't know their history. No, I didn't ask because it's none of my business. But, you know, they met me a couple of three times. And by the second or third time, they're like, okay, this guy's okay. He's just weird. Got it. Right? That's not PPD. That's not delusional disorder. That's, we don't know what the hell to do with this guy because he's weird and different.
and that's degree, a great that's example a of, you know, what I was saying earlier about people stereotyping stuff is just because strangers itch you out a little bit does not mean you have a pathology.
Right. I mean, and I'll tell you a quick story for the listeners, which I think is really funny, and it's absolutely true. So one of the builders that we were introduced to, I went out there the second time to look at some property, and the real estate agent had us. I took Mr. Happy with me. I took Seth with me because he knows about building, and I don't know dog squat about that stuff. So Toby, the real estate agent, who is really on his game, had us set up interviewing with four different builders. So one of the builders he set us up with, who will remain nameless for obvious reasons, excuse me, were actually the builders I ended up picking. But what was funny about it is Toby went to the builder, and he was Toby's first choice. Went to the builder, who's just very, you know, old school, down to earth. Says to the builder, "Hey, I got this doctor coming from Atlanta who I think you're really going to like. I think you're going to be a good match." And the guy goes, "Stop! I'm not meeting this guy." And he goes, "Why not?" He goes, "He's probably some yuppie ass doctor from Atlanta, and he's probably going to come here and tell me how to build, and I just don't have time for this kind of foolishness. Yada yada yada. I'm not going to meet him. I'm not interested." He goes home and tells his wife, "Oh my God, Toby's lost his mind. He wants to meet this snooty ass doctor from Atlanta and stuff." And his wife's like, "Oh my God, shame on you. You should be ashamed. You call yourself a Christian. You're judging this guy before you've even met him. Oh my God." So she basically guilts him into meeting me, right? So Toby pulls up to the build site where this guy is working on a house, and we get out, and he sees me with Seth and with Toby, and he's kind of looking at me like, huh? And we walk up, and Toby goes, oh, and it was hilarious. And Toby goes, "Hi, this is Dr. Matheson." I went, "Hey, I'm Steven. You know, I'm just, you know, come on. I know who I am. I don't need everybody to, you know, bow down three times to the setting sun. Come on." Right. And he introduces Seth, right? So Seth and the builder start talking shop, and I'm like, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to go look at the house and check out stuff. So I was hanging out with some of the builder's workers who were very cool, and Toby, and we were looking at the house. So Seth and the builder are talking for a while, right? So we and the builder agrees to meet us on the property the next day. And I said to Toby, I said, "This is definitely the guy I want. I'm getting good vibes. I like the way he's done his house." And Seth was all impressed with him. So he meets the builder on Seth goes and meets the builder on the property the next day to walk the land to get some opinions. And the builder says, "Yeah, you know, I got a confession to make." And he tells Seth the story.
Oh, no.
You know, and he's kind of got his head. And he's kind of got his head down, and he's kind of got his eyes to the floor. He's like all embarrassed, right? He's like, and I've never been more wrong about any guys in my life. Oh, my God. Right? And so Seth comes back to the hotel telling me the story. And I'm laughing my assets off. I'm like, oh, my God, that is too funny. But that's an example of a guy who's probably been burned, right, by another doctor or by some person from a big city coming there telling him this small town guy how to build homes, right? And so he's been sensitized. He's like, no, I don't have time for that stuff, and I don't believe him, right? So he's made a judgment. He meets me. He goes, okay, wait a minute. He's just weird. He's okay. You know, that's just a guy who's suspicious probably because of previous situations.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? But he's clearly not delusional, and he clearly doesn't have paranoid personality disorder.
Right.
So
fair enough.
There's your difference. So that's a great, I always use that as a great pragmatic example to say, you know, sometimes it's kind of okay to be suspicious and cautious.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you can take, you know, it's just like degrees. You can take anything too far. You can be kind of compulsive, and at some things you want to be really compulsive, and other things, not so much.
Gotcha.
Gotcha.
You got to balance it, right? Everything in life's a balance.
Yep. All right. Let me sneak in one other quick question here.
Sure.
The other thing I didn't see a lot of notes on were I'm getting a little echo from me. I don't know if you can turn me down just a tiny bit.
Sure.
Differential diagnoses for PPD. I found stuff for delusional disorder, but is there any differential diagnosis notes for PPD that you are aware of? Because I couldn't really find that.
Well, you got the diagnostic criteria, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we did cover that earlier. So, you know,
right.
I didn't know if there was anything additional you wanted to put in there about that.
No, it's just when you're looking at the diagnostic criteria, and I just took a quick glance at my DSM-5. You have to have 4 out of those to get diagnosed the disorder.
Okay. All right. Cool. Well, then let's go to the differential diagnosis notes for delusional disorder.
Okay.
This one I did find, and this is what they said. Obsessive compulsive and related disorders. In cases that involve an individual feeling that his or her obsessive compulsive disorder beliefs are true, a delusional disorder diagnosis should not be made, but rather an obsessive compulsive disorder with absent insight delusional belief specifier. This remains
true.
Yeah, this remains true for other disorders such as body dysmorphic disorder. Another one is schizophrenia and schizophreniform disorder. I haven't run into that word before. The absence of other characteristics of the active phase of schizophrenia can differentiate delusional disorder from schizophrenia and schizophreniform disorder. Depressive and bipolar disorders and schizoaffective disorder. If delusions only present themselves during mood episodes, the diagnosis is depressive or bipolar disorder with psychotic features. Delusional disorder is to only be diagnosed if the total duration of all mood episodes is brief compared to the period of delusions. And the last one is delirium, major neurocognitive disorder, psychotic disorder due to another medical condition, and substance medication-induced psychotic disorder.
It's like you have a reaction to medication that puts you into la-la land.
Yeah. So,
like, for example, I think you know that I'm allergic to penicillin. When I take penicillin, I literally become schizophrenic. So I have hallucinations in all 5 sense modes.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How long
I don't
does
get
that
hives
take to come
like
down?
Most people. Yeah, I don't get hives like most people. Of course, you know, because you're a weirdo from Atlanta. I'm that weird doctor from Atlanta.
This explains so much.
So that's an example of that. And some people become so OC that they, you know, they get in a minute where they're like crazy, and then they kind of come out of it, right? So they, and you can get bipolar people who are in a manic phase, and they get so high in the manic phase, they have temporary psychotic features, or they can be so depressed. And this is not like the Johnny Carson joke. How depressed are they? But in a way,
no.
It is. Well, they're so depressed, they get psychotic, but it goes away.
Okay, got it. All right. The rest of the note said individuals with these disorders may show symptoms that point to delusional disorder. Example, simple persecutory delusions in major neurocognitive disorder would be diagnosed as major neurocognitive disorder with behavioral disturbance. Is there anything else that you want to add to that part before we get to the end?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, so the last part, resources and coping with either paranoid personality disorder and or delusional disorder. So this is about treatment, basically. So first is, how is paranoid personality disorder treated? So people with PPD often do not seek treatment on their own because they do not see themselves as having a problem. This is one of several disorders that we've talked about on this show where that's a thing. The distrust of others felt by people with PPD also poses a challenge for healthcare professionals, because trust is an important factor of psychotherapy, it's a form of counseling. As a result, many people with PPD do not follow the treatment plan and may even question the motives of the therapist. When a patient seeks treatment for PPD, psychotherapy is usually the treatment of choice. Treatment likely will focus on increasing general coping skills, especially
yes.
trust and empathy, as well as on improving social interaction, communication, and self-esteem. Medication generally is not used to treat PPD. However, medications such as anti-anxiety, antidepressant, or antipsychotics might be prescribed if the person's symptoms are extreme, or if he or she also suffers from an associated psychological problem such as anxiety or depression. Is there anything else that you want to add about treating PPD?
Yeah, I can tell you that in general I've had really good success with PPD, but that's, you know, you point stuff out to people and if they're miserable enough, they'll try what you're suggesting. And if you try, you teach them some coping skills and say, okay, here's things you look for in social situations, and here's the evidence, and you want only evidence-based stuff and nothing else, and then here's the cognitive restructuring you do to talk to yourself out of these, you know, moments when you feel like, oh, my God, right? Most of the folks can get better with that. Some people are resistant to do it, but I've had pretty good success with it. I never advise people do medication with this, even if they have co-occurring anxiety or depression disorders, particularly the anxiety stuff, because all of the anxiolytics have an incredible addiction potential, and that's the last thing these people need.
Got it. Yeah. Okay, that's fair.
I will often recommend dietary and holistic stuff, but not formal medication stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's often your go-to for quite a few things, and understandably.
Right.
Let's go ahead and talk real quick about treating delusional disorder. So while DD can be a difficult one to treat, affected individuals do have a few options. As often happens, you know, psychotherapy, and there's mention of medications, so we'll get to that in a second. So psychotherapy, this is typically the most effective treatment for individuals suffering from delusional disorder. The therapist will avoid directly challenging the delusional beliefs and instead concentrate on realistic problems and goals the person has. Then when a solid relationship has been established between therapist and patient, the therapist can start reinforcing positive behaviors of the individual. As far as medications, antipsychotic medication is the most common form used to treat delusional disorder. However, this treatment approach can be problematic as patients may become suspicious of professionals suggesting the use of medication. Is there anything else that you want to add to that? I don't know if the same meds are used, if they use meds.
Yeah,
the ones
absolutely.
That have potential for addiction. Okay, so there's the addiction
absolutely.
Question again.
Yeah, antipsychotics are the treatment of choice here for if you're going to do that. But the problem is, you're right, the problem is a lot of times people go, you're just trying to poison me. You're trying to control my mind. And like, okay, So sometimes you have to establish a relationship first. I typically don't work with delusional disorder patients. I suck with these people. I'm really bad with these folks. I don't deal well with people who aren't dealing with reality, which is I'll diagnose these folks. I'll diagnose schizophrenics. I'll diagnose schizophreniforms. I won't work with them. I'm very inappropriate for these people because I just want to shake them and go, come on, this is crazy crap. Stop this crazy crap out. Oh, yeah, that's going to help them. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's not really the professional way to handle
it. Yeah, that's not a therapeutic approach that has been statistically verified. So I just go, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, to quote Clint Eastwood, a man's got to know his limitations. Right? And so
yeah.
This
well,
is one of
know,
mine.
To be fair, it is good to know when this is something that's not your bailiwick. You know,
right, and I have a referral list of folks who are great with these people, and it's just a win-win for everybody.
Cool. Good to know. Is there anything else that you want to add in that we maybe didn't cover fully enough or any other tidbits that you want to throw in here?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So I did not update my summary in the script, but essentially this is wrapping up the conclusion of the show. So we hope that you guys better understand, you know, paranoia gets thrown around a lot, but there are actual definitions for these things. And like many pathologies, you guys should not just decide, you know, what something is and then start calling things by names and, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, do your homework. So this concludes our show on paranoid personality disorder versus delusional disorder. And on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank you guys this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we will see you in 2 weeks for a new topic of discussion on Wednesday, March 3rd, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. And we'd also like to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. I don't have updates for too many of them. I do have one for tomorrow for Travel Itch Radio. Thursday, Travel Itch Radio, 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent Lee, marking its 400th episode on February 18th. Travel Itch Radio presents 5 guests in specially arranged 12-minute segments. So the show airing live at 8 p.m. on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio will feature the following. Tony, I don't know how to pronounce Tony's last name. It's M-U-I-A. I don't want to butcher it. he's from A Slice of Brooklyn Bus Tours, Brooklyn Pizza Tour. Sue Presby of the Mount Washington Cog Railway. Barbara Golden of Florida's Historic Coast in St. Augustine. And Marjorie Beenders of Mid-Missouri and the Winston Churchill Museum. And Doug McKenzie of Greater Phoenix. Join show founder and executive producer Dan Schlossberg and co-host Mary Ellen Nugent Lee for this wide-ranging show. Saturday's Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday Morning Extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday Morning Quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. Sunday, 8:30 p.m., February 28th, The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead, World Beyond online viewing party will resume. I'll have more info on that for you guys later. Although actually we will be resuming before the Rock and Roll Shrink reconvenes. So you guys will just have to come on Sunday night, the 28th, and see what's going on with the dead guys. All right. Monday, 10 p.m., Monday night in America, Roger Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. This show may alternate on some Monday nights with our new show, The Nightmare Hunter, with Roger Noriega in the same time slot. And Tuesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Fandom Access, Week in Review. Join the ingenious insights of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they digest another night of TV. All right, please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. We appreciate you guys joining us. Talk to you next time. Take care. Thanks, and good night.